2050. The Climate Scorecard awarded firms grades based on their involvement in lawsuits exacerbating climate change, their support for fossil fuel transactions, and fees received for lobbying on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. Paul Weiss, a top 10 US firm according to VaultLaw's rankings, was one of the 37 to receive the lowest F grade. According to the scorecard, the firm, which has its own sustainability practice, has acted for fossil fuel companies in 30 cases over the last 5 years. Among the most high profile was the firm's work representing ExxonMobil in a landmark trial where the company was accused of having misled investors about the risks of climate change to its business. The court ruled in favor of ExxonMobil in 2019. Paul Weiss did not respond to a request for comment. Only 12 law firms were rated A or B in the scorecard, which meant they did not conduct work for fossil fuel clients. According to the scorecard report, three firms, Cooley, Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, and Shorter Roth and Zabel, have actively addressed the climate crisis through renewable energy transactions, lobbying, or pro-climate litigation. Tim Herschel Burns said, "We definitely agree that the law can be this force for good. But one thing that we found really striking is that overwhelmingly the top law firms are representing the wrong side of it." Alyssa Joel, legal director for the Center for Climate Integrity, said there is a tangible human cost. Alyssa Joel added, "Elite law firms are representing the oil and gas companies and providing them with a deep bench of high-priced lawyers." She said, "For the communities across the country that are seeking justice, the end result is that their cases have been delayed and bogged down by procedural hurdles put forward by some of the biggest law firms in the country." Law Students for Climate Accountability is calling on law firms to pledge to stop taking on new fossil fuel industry work, phase out their current work by 2025, and ramp up their work for the renewable energy industry and in support of litigation to tackle the climate crisis. It's a potentially controversial stance given the principle that everyone should have access to legal representation. But Tim Herschel Burns said this principle is often used in really sloppy ways which end up justifying law firms being able to represent whoever pays the most. Some firms have acknowledged the choice. Speaking at a conference last year about the link between law and climate change, the global senior partner at Clifford Chance Jeroen Urnhand said, "Firms can choose what we support and what we don't support. We do not have to be neutral professional service providers." Law firms are starting to ramp up their own climate action, even as they continue their fossil fuel work. A number of firms that scored F grades on the climate scorecard, including Shearman and Sterling and Hogan Lovells, have signed up to the Net Zero Lawyers Alliance, which launched in July. Members pledge to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 and to work with clients to embed climate goals and to help drive systematic change. Neither firm responded to the Guardian's request for comment. Another alliance member, DLA Piper, has set its own science-based target to halve all emissions by 2030, including indirect emissions from the firm's supply chain. The firm was recently appointed official legal service provider for the forthcoming COP26 climate talks in Glasgow. But it scored only a D on the climate scorecard and has represented clients including Shell, ExxonMobil and BP. The firm declined to comment. Tom Wetzer, a law professor and director of the Oxford Sustainable Law Programme, one of the organisations supporting the alliance, said, "The firms may be serious about taking steps in the right direction, but they do not necessarily have the best practices as yet." Tom Wetzer added, "We need to move the whole sector, and for many firms involved, this is the start of a long journey." Some law firms that ranked low on the climate scorecard were keen to promote their green energy work. Allen and Overy, which according to the scorecard worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $125 billion over the last 5 years, claimed in a statement that it does more renewable work than any other law firm in the world by most key measures. Clifford Chance, which the scorecard calculated worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $123 billion, said it is perennially at or near the top for advising on renewable financing. But neither firm, both of which scored an F, responded to questions about how they reconcile their work with their representation of fossil fuel firms. Tom Wetzer said, "Lawyers have a responsibility to reflect on their own role and to ask whether their clients' values align with their own." He added, "Firms that engage constructively with a net zero transition will be rewarded. Clients will value their judgment and expertise, top talent will be more easily attracted and retained, and these firms will strengthen their social license to operate." Sam Sankar, of the non-profit environmental law organization Earth Justice, which makes the climate scorecard a powerful tool, said law firms' best resource is their employees, adding, "In the future, nobody is going to think twice about making career decisions with an eye to whether it aligns with their climate ethics." Sam Sankar said, "There is now a conversation about legal ethics and climate, which is well overdue," adding, "The fossil fuel industry is paying law firms tons of money in an effort to dodge responsibility and block regulatory reforms that could help avert this crisis."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Living Hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka choo. It's the Youth Station for you. Here in the studio today, we have with us myself, Muzaffar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, welcome to Youth Station. I'm Zainab.
What percentage of Islam is in Muslims' lifestyle?
Do you consider yourself as a practicing Muslim?
Yeah. What about you?
Yes.
Yeah. Alhamdulillah.
Yes.
Alhamdulillah.
Yes. Alhamdulillah. Rabbil alamin.
Thank God.
Yeah, definitely.
We are practicing Muslims. I think that's the least we can say about ourselves.
Yeah.
The most that we can say about ourselves. But yeah, when you look around, you see some people who are not practicing Islam.
Mm. What does practicing Islam mean, though? Is it just about praying and fasting and doing Hajj and praying your homes?
I think to an extent, yes.
Only?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. There's that literal hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. His eminence says, don't look at how long the ruku' and sujood is. Rather, look at how they interact with others, how trustworthy they are, how honest, how kind.
Yeah, I mean, but if they're not trustworthy, then they're actually lying, which means that they're telling a sin, which they're doing a sin, which
exactly.
Means that they're
I
not
mean, I'm saying that sure, Salat is the pillar of religion, right? And as the Hadith states, if it's accepted, the rest are accepted. If it's not accepted, the rest won't be accepted either, mm-hmm. right? But we have to understand that if someone does observe Salat, right, but is a jerk in society, right, it means that, and being a jerk is not accepted by God, right?
Yeah.
It means that their Salat wasn't accepted.
Okay.
And it led to them being a jerk, right?
Yeah. Because
and
Salat is the fulcrum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
تنهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر.
Ahsant, yeah. It protects you from indecencies and vulgarity.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right? So I'm saying that we can't necessarily say just because a person prays and fasts or a woman wears hijab that they have a high percentage of Islam in their lives. That's what I'm trying to say. But
at the same time, I mean, Islam means to submit. I mean, they're practicing all those basic rules.
Why
right?
are they doing it? Cleanliness is part of faith.
Oh, yeah, I completely forgot
and
about
you know,
that.
Dude, like, everything about what you're doing is non-Islamic. It's against Sunnah, it's against the Quran, it's against everything. No, I don't want to say, why do you think just because you pray and you fast, you're going to go to heaven? I ain't here to judge.
Mm.
But I'm saying that, why do you think it's all about just praying and fasting? Right?
Mm.
Smelling good isn't necessarily as important as praying. Rasulullah never said changing your socks at the pillar of religion, mm. right? Mm. He said Salat is, but it's these little details.
A lot of what the prophets and imams did was trying to get us to become more intellectual. The more intellectual somebody is, they will just naturally want to keep clean. They will naturally want to clothe themselves. They'll naturally want to be polite with others.
And smell nice.
A lot of people are practicing the deen without any intellectual introspection.
Exactly.
This is a beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, there is no goodness in the deen except that which you contemplate over. I've been looking for that hadith my whole life, I'm telling
exactly,
you.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. Hold that thought. The train is taking a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We talked about how it's uncool to do taqleed, to mimic, to imitate our religion. Unless like in ahkam,
yeah.
right? We downright, well, I don't have the time to go study for years and years and years and acquire ijtihad
mm.
and know all the specific rules regarding
yeah.
all the obligatory acts.
But
exactly.
even in akhlaq, you can do taqleed to
from
a certain
Rasulullah.
Extent. From the Holy Prophet, from the Ahlul Bayt.
Yeah, by taqleed, I mean that we copy our parents because they prayed and fasted, right? That's why we did not come to an intellectual understanding of those acts. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
We copy our parents because they brush their teeth. Why is it that children that after they've grown up and they've become exposed to the society and they hang out with perhaps not the right people, they stop fasting, they stop praying, they sometimes consume stuff that
because
they're not supposed to.
Yeah. They didn't have an intellectual foundation
exactly.
for following those things in the first
yeah.
place.
But there wasn't enough Islam.
Yeah. Have you seen I Am Legend?
No.
I Am Legend, Will Smith. You have seen it.
I've watched the trailer. I've read about it.
They're good enough. There's a guy who's just completely alone, right? It's actually
Apocalypse.
Based on a novel. A zombie, well, whatever. But he
is
completely...
I thought they were vampires.
Huh?
I thought they were vampires.
They are... It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The point is that he is completely alone. There are no other human beings around
him. But he has a doggo,
him.
Right?
It's not a good feel. It's just... Don't watch it. It's just... It's rubbish.
Why is it miserable?
They made the real version. They followed the book. And the book says that, you know... he eventually realizes that all of those vampires that he was fighting were actually, they'd gained a consciousness of their own. So he is actually the monster now.
Cute.
That was what the book said.
Okay, I'm not going to watch it because the dog dies. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, the dog dies.
All right, so but what happens in the legend?
They showed this to an American audience, and apparently the audience just could not intellectually comprehend that the hero is the bad guy in the end. Oh, no. So they had to change the whole ending, and the new ending is just rubbish.
Okay. So, and the point is?
The point is that if we imagine ourselves in the scenario of the hero of that tale, who is completely alone, would you still pray Salah? That would answer so much for you. Would you still pray Salah? Would you still do these du'as?
Would you?
That's a personal question. Would you?
Yeah, because what else am I going to do?
Survive? But, okay, inshallah, right, we do. But that answers the question. Are we really Muslims? How much of Islam have we really implemented in ourselves?
Exactly.
How much of it is just because of our circumstances? I'm in this place, I'm in an Islamic
country,
I'm not in an Islamic country. Some people even adopt the hijab, for example, for their daughters in their family. You look at the sons in the family, they're completely outrageous.
Exactly.
They follow like none of Islam. But you girls, you have to wear hijab. Why?
Hijab.
It's not because of Islam. It's not because Allah wants this.
Tradition
it's because
and culture.
I, as a man of the house, I need to control these ladies, because if the guys go and do something bad, nobody really cares. Mm-hmm. Society doesn't even look bat an eyelid, right? But if the girls go bad,
everyone loses.
Oh my God, my reputation has gone down the drain. That's why we're really doing it, and
exactly.
We have to ask ourselves: is that why we're implementing Islam?
That's the question we constantly need to ask ourselves: why are we doing it? Flashback, throwback to when I asked you whether you consider yourself a practicing Muslim.
That was last episode.
Yeah, but you said yes, right, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I'm a practicing.
Why?
Muslim. I'm a proud practicing.
Why?
Muslim. Why? If I say, oh, because Allah wants me to, because that's the right answer. That's why we should be following Islam, because it pleases Allah.
Mm.
I'll find out on the day of judgment myself.
It just makes sense to me, right?
Yeah.
At this point in my life where I am, this makes sense.
What? We have a short break to go to? Welcome back. We've been talking about what percentage of Islam is in Muslims' lifestyle.
Practicing Islam.
Well, but then if your life changes, then I don't know until then.
Maybe it will change for the worse.
God
maybe
protect
it will
us.
Change
See,
it for the better.
It's really complicated. Actually, look, the reality is this. And lots of youths ask this kind of question, right? They say, my best friend, John, you know, he's not a Muslim. He doesn't really believe in God, but he's really nice because he gave me a PlayStation game, you know? Youths have these kinds of questions,
yeah.
And even when we haven't matured out of them, even when we grow into later life as well, I've had women, like grown women, mothers, coming and asking the same question. Well, what about Mrs. Findlay down the road? She's not a bad person. Is she going to burn in hell just because she didn't say La ilaha illallah?
It depends.
I don't believe in that. Right.
It honestly depends.
It does depend.
Or, you know, often you see a lot of people who are totally anti-religion, especially in media, but they're so charitable and they're so helpful and they're so giving and they're
and
so
at
honest.
At the same time, you see somebody like Bill Gates or something, and they're giving like, they have a whole foundation, they're giving loads and loads of charity, and you think to yourself, well, they've given much more charity than I ever will, therefore they're a much better person, and
maybe they are.
Maybe they are.
And Allah
maybe
compensated for the likes of Bill Gates. Come on, he's a cajillionaire.
Yeah. Let's say that you don't know. In fact, this is the reality. You don't know. You
exactly.
don't even know where
yes.
you are.
Yes,
okay,
yes,
you
yes,
don't.
Yes.
You can try to be a Muslim or a Mu'min or a Shia or whatever. Try to be. But do you know what you really are? No, you don't. Only on the Day of Judgment will you know. And that same person who was preaching to you, right, that so-called scholar. There is a hadith that says when a person goes on the Day of Judgment and, you know, he's risen in a good form and, you know, he's going to be given good deeds and, you know, his good deeds are coming back to him now. He's going to see that scholar who preached to him going towards the hellfire.
Oh, no.
And he's going to say to him, how can you be going to the hellfire?
You taught me this.
You taught me this. And the scholar will say, yes, I taught you, but I never applied any myself.
Oh, my God.
Okay?
God
so
forbid.
There are many, many good people in the world who you think are good, over there you're going to see that they are very, very bad.
You know, bad. They're terrible. See, and this is where it
and
comes.
And the vice versa as well. Exactly. The opposite is true as well. Thus, very, very. You might see the nastiest people, right?
Yeah.
He's a drug addict. I don't know. He's like got wild hair, and he's like that guy. But then on the day of judgment, he could be really good, and
Allah
you don't
could
know,
cut him,
right?
You know,
because why? Because he's tried his hardest, and that's the best he could do.
That's life
poor
circumstances
guy.
For him, and thus enters. Don't judge anyone.
No.
I firmly believe we're not allowed to judge. Not in the whole like, okay, let anyone, I'm going to do whatever I want, and I am going to consider myself immune to all forms of criticism because only God can judge me. That's not what I mean. I can judge for myself, right, who I want and do not want in my life. You know, whose energy do I appreciate and whose vibe do I find totally toxic for myself.
If you want to know a person's deen, look at his friends.
Exactly. Look at the people he hangs out with. But also, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said to Malik al-Ashtar that if you see someone sinning at night, don't look at them in the same eyes tomorrow morning because they might have repented throughout the night and you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Only Allah knows a person's background, their history, their potential, their capacity, their intentions.
I think, would this make sense? Don't judge the batin. Don't judge what is inside. You don't know what's inside.
Yeah.
You don't know the entire world that's going on behind the scenes. But you need to judge the exterior.
The action itself.
Right? The action itself.
Is
say,
wrong.
This is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
This thing which this so-and-so person is doing is
wrong. But
yeah.
I can't judge whether they will or will not go to hell.
They might be in a better place than we
are. Exactly. You know, but really, honestly, maybe they were genuinely ignorant or abused in some form or way.
There's lots
and
of people
yeah.
who are abused, and so they
in the name
abusers.
Of religion, and they totally just went berserk. And honestly, I don't blame them. And that's all the time we have for today's episode.
We hope that you enjoyed listening to this train of thought with myself and with Sister Zainab Barakat.
Thank you so much, you guys, for being with us on today's episode of Youth Station. Until another salam and greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness and my love.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and the disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under a scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram. But it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, led by the United States, has long been on a confrontational course with Russia. Developments on the ground on Russia's western borders and elsewhere are pointing to increasing tensions between the two sides. The Western Alliance has been moving military hardware and ground forces to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. The situation in Ukraine has turned into another serious bone of contention. NATO and Russia have been flexing their military muscles. The two have shown through their military drills and deployments, as well as public statements, that they are serious about pursuing their geopolitical interests in the Baltic region, the Middle East, and even in the Arctic. Meanwhile, America's ongoing efforts to complete a comprehensive missile system in Europe have further worried Moscow. Radars, warships, and long-range missile interceptors placed across Europe form components of the controversial system.
Without the Soviet Union, NATO does not need to exist, and they are clinging for dear life. They're trying to justify, to create a reason for them to be there and to continue to exist. And that's why they're constantly provoking Russia when Russia is not the Soviet Union. They are not the threat that the Soviet Union was.
As NATO expands eastward, Russia is not sitting idly by. It has adopted a set of countermeasures. For instance, Russia has used its westernmost territory, Kaliningrad, as a platform to boost its defenses. The territory is located between Poland and Lithuania on the Baltic Sea. Moscow has deployed the Iskander missiles and its S-400 air defense systems in Kaliningrad. NATO and Moscow have maintained contacts to try to minimize risks. The Russian Federation has had an observer mission to the Western Alliance. It was meant to promote cooperation in common security areas. This week, tensions between the two sides escalated once again after NATO expelled some members of the Russian mission. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the organization expelled the 8 Russian diplomats over a rise in, quote, malign activities by Moscow. The Russian government was quick to slam NATO's decision. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that there is an obvious inconsistency in statements by NATO representatives about their desire to normalize relations with Russia and in their actual actions. He added that such actions allow Moscow not to develop illusions about the normalization of relations. Meanwhile, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, Leonid Slutsky, warned of asymmetric retaliatory measures. How will this latest episode of tensions between the two sides play out? NATO's relations with Moscow have largely been tied to the policies of the United States. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Joe Biden has made it clear that his administration will be tough on Moscow. In his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed 2 new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden has repeated accusations of interference in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses against Russia. Washington and Moscow were also locked in a dispute over embassy staffing, which could further sour their ties. Analysts believe that the rivalry between the Russian Federation and the West, including NATO, is too deep-rooted to be solved in any foreseeable future.
The biggest ever data leak in history has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other public officials from over 90 countries. Nearly 3 terabytes of data, dubbed the Pandora Papers, were leaked to the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Over 600 journalists helped review 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Jordan's King Abdullah, a close U.S. ally, was reported to have used offshore accounts to spend more than $100 million on luxury homes in the United Kingdom and the United States. The papers also accused the family and close associates of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev of corruption, suggesting that they've traded close to £400 million in UK property over the past 15 years through a network of offshore firms. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, presidents of Ukraine, Cyprus, Kenya, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures.
Because people don't want to solve it. It's very simple. I mean, first of all, bear in mind, the central banks around the globe have opened up their money spigots to extraordinary levels since the 2008 financial crisis. So as a result, you have tons and tons and tons of capital circulating around the world, unregulated, looking for the highest profit levels, etc. And the banking sectors are making lots and lots of money over this.
While having offshore firms and accounts isn't illegal, The papers allege that some of the companies have helped officials hide their wealth, practically enabling them to evade paying taxes, while some others have used them for money laundering and other fraudulent financial schemes. According to the Pandora Papers, over a dozen U.S. states are providing financial secrecy services that rival those of offshore tax havens in Europe and the Caribbean region. The documents single out South Dakota, which has allegedly sheltered billions of dollars in assets linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The investigation says South Dakota state lawmakers have adopted lax regulations drafted by trust industry insiders, measures that have quadrupled customers' trust in the state compared to 10 years ago. Some of the trusts cited in the probe are linked to people accused of human rights and labor abuses. The revelations come despite President Joe Biden's pledge that Washington will lead the efforts internationally to promote financial transparency and fight against corruption.
Now, the U.S., for example, talks about equalizing tax rates, shutting down tax havens, et cetera, but in fact, individual U.S. states have been opening their doors wider and wider to these kinds of activities. South Dakota is one example, Nevada is another, and a third is Delaware, a small state on the East Coast, which is home to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's history, he essentially is a product of this anything goes, hot money, corporate culture.
The rich and powerful people cited in the large-scale investigation have already begun to deny wrongdoings and in some cases express readiness to undergo scrutiny. What's for certain is that they have a lot to answer for in their respective countries for the months or even years to come.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Salam, the Islamic salutations. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Among the salutations of various nations, Salam, the Islamic salutation and greeting, has a special luminosity because it indicates both welcoming and peace, pleasure and friendship, and also a wish for peace from God for the other party. This is what Salam holds in itself. When we say Assalamu Alaikum, or we say Salamullah Alayh, right? This is where we are implying all these things. It's a parcel and package. In today's world, though, we use it as just a way of greeting without paying too much attention towards the meaning of what we are saying. This is the most comprehensive way of greeting someone. Islam has provided it for us. For this reason, the salutation of people of paradise is Salam. And angels of mercy receive the virtuous and good doers with salam. Unfortunately, some egoistic Muslims think that it's, you know, not saluting or not sending salutations or not being able to be the first one to salute someone or to send salutation reflects their high status, and saluting reduces their ranks. And we see this in our societies, right? That you don't really initiate salam. So many times we see, especially with the people who are arrogant, They wait for the other person to say salam, and then they decide whether they're going to respond to that person or not and how good that response is going to be. Islam has promoted us and encouraged us to initiate in sending salam on the other person. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing one of the very ethical and moral traits of Islam, which is sending salutations and doing salam to other people, the Islamic salutations. Before the break, we were discussing how some people are so arrogant that they don't want to initiate salam, and even if somebody says salam to them, they are, you know, thinking about whether they're going to respond to them with a salam or not. This is un-Islamic and unacceptable. You know, by doing this, they deprive themselves of the great reward mentioned in the traditions of Islam, especially for those who show humility by taking the initiative to salute first and send salutations first. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the third infallible Imam, has said, salam or salutation has 70 rewards, 69 parts of which are for one who salutes, and one part of which is for one who returns the salutation. So if you initiate the salam, and if you are the first one to say salamu alaikum, then you are getting 69 rewards, as compared to only one reward that you get when you respond to a salam. As we know that in Islamic jurisprudence, saying salam is mustahab, which is recommended, and responding to a salam is wajib, which is obligatory. So try to be the first one to initiate the salam, whether it to be the elders or your age mates or even the youngers. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, they used to try their level best to initiate salam, even with the youth, the younger ones. So we need to get into habit of sending Islamic salutations on our mu'min and believer brothers and sisters. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The strongest foundation for building humans exists in the warm and blessed family center, the 3rd of February, 2021. Some say that the hijab hinders a woman's growth and advancement. No, it is the other way around, because hijab prevents those useless ostentations that prevent a woman from moving forward. Today, we have thousands of great and prominent women in various scientific, practical, social, political, and technical fields, all of whom are living by wearing a complete hijab. Well, when we look at women in this way, their role in the family becomes also prominent. Their role as a mother, a wife, the lady of the house, and the like. This is what is becoming less and less important in the West. The family is declining in the West. The family is a warm and blessed center in which the strongest foundations of human education are laid. It is the center of family that the first and most important foundations of human, spiritual, and intellectual education are established. Home is the best place for the comfort of body and soul. It is the best center for relieving the fatigue of body and soul. It is the most real environment for intimacy. No intimacy is imagined or exists in any environment as much as in the family and between the mother, children, the father, and the wife in the family. Who is the pivot of this blessed center? The mother. Who is the main element? The mother. Who is the center of the circle? The mother. The mother is the pivot of the family. Western propaganda machines, and unfortunately some westernized figures inside our own country, are trying to undermine this. They either try to make the people misunderstand this, or they avoid showing the mother's role at all. Housewives and those who do not work outside home have rendered the greatest services. It is necessary to appreciate the value of those women who have preferred to be housewives. Although women have had, do have, and will have duties outside home, and although there is nothing wrong with this, their most important service is attending to household duties.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemenis have held an event in front of the Asala al-Kubra community hall in Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the fifth anniversary of a massacre committed by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Participants condemned the international silence toward this brutal crime, saying when it comes to Yemen, the West continues to show its double standards. Abdusalam Amir is one of those who were present during the attack, where he got injured.
On that day, the sheikhs of the Nihim tribe and I attended to offer condolences to the Al-Ruwaishan family because of our relationship with them. I was sitting there when the unexpected happened, a terrorist crime that killed and injured more than 700 of the best men of Yemen. This criminal act does not differ from the terrorist operations carried out by the coalition of aggression in all cities of Yemen over the past years, and the source of all these crimes is the extremist Wahhabi ideology led by the House of Saud.
On October 8, 2016, Saudi warplanes targeted the Asala al-Kubra community hall in Sana'a with at least two air-dropped munitions during a funeral ceremony. Over 140 people were killed and more than 600 others were injured in the attack, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
People here say the bombing of the funeral ceremony at the Asala al-Kubra community hall revealed the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis. They say Riyadh's crimes will never be forgotten and Saudi Arabia should be brought to justice for its crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus, and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Maqdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue. We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an international and regional tour which started in Russia. Abdullahian's visit sends a clear message to the enemies of the resistance alliance that decades-long ties between the two countries are constantly developing, despite Western and Israeli pressures on both states. It's clear that the two countries maintain the same stance that resistance is the only path to victory in the face of their mutual enemies. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
An official France-Africa summit was organized by French President Macron in the southern French city Montpellier. He had invited state-linked members of the civil society and entrepreneurs. But even there, official participants criticized the colonial and paternalistic attitude of France in Africa. Later at the protest march and the counter-summit, held at the same time and in the same city, African analysts and human rights watchdogs said that France continues to exploit African countries, transferring uranium and other natural resources to Europe.
The position of France concerning authoritarian and dictatorial regimes has not changed. This was obvious when Macron went to Chad to support the son of former dictator Déby. France is maintaining its policy of political and military interference to defend its economic interests. France has not changed in this respect.
Political analyst Aziz Fall from Burkina Faso said that France is losing ground in Africa and is therefore using new tactics to seduce the civil society.
Well, basically, the French power is losing its grip in the region.
And this is a major change compared to the so-called Cold War era. We have seen Russian, we have seen Chinese coming to the fierce competition, and we are witnessing a new scramble. The Americans are here, so the French need to review the way they will access to wealth in the country. And this is supposed to get rid of the support they have offered to these sellout readers that are still leading our country.
Migrants formed